Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Racial tensions are high after the last couple of weeks. The police killings of two black men and now eight police killed in two separate attacks. These tensions can show up at work, too. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports some coworkers are struggling to find the words to help make things better.
The day after two white policemen shot Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge, Contonius Gill went to work and got into a discussion with one of his white female coworkers, whose brother happens to be an officer. The woman defended the police in the Sterling shooting. Gill, who is black, couldn't let that stand.
I didn't walk away because I want her to know that you're not going to say something that I disagree with or something that's erroneous, and I just leave you with your thoughts. Since you left me with your thoughts, I'll leave you with mine.
The conversation was intense but civil. Gill, a network administrator in Charlotte, North Carolina, says it was unusual. His white colleagues usually don't seem comfortable talking about race.
I think that people maybe expect a lid to come off or something, you know, because, of course, I mean, I do have a lot of feelings about it.
He has a lot of feelings, in part because 3 years ago, Gill and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission won a race discrimination suit against his former employer, trucking firm A.C. Widenhouse. A jury found he was subject to racial slurs and threats to, quote, hang from our family tree. Race isn't just touchy for workers. It can also create problems for employers. Racial discrimination and harassment at work is illegal. And in the last 3 years, the number of such cases filed with the EEOC has increased. Even if an incident doesn't go to court, experts say employers that don't act fairly and decisively to punish racist behavior risk demoralizing their workforce and hurting productivity. And while free speech rights apply to personal speech outside of work, employers are increasingly concerned about how workers' online posts affect the workplace. For example, in the days following the Dallas police killings, the Nashville Police Department decommissioned two officers for inflammatory postings on Facebook. In one of them, Officer Anthony Venable, who is white, wrote in an apparent defense of the Minnesota policeman who shot Philando Castile four times, quote, "Yeah, I would have done five." Police Chief Steve Anderson told Nashville Public Radio the incident is under investigation.
He may have disqualified himself to be a police officer.
3 days later, another Nashville officer, Christopher Taylor, was decommissioned after posting a photo of the Black Panthers on his page. Howard Ross, a diversity consultant, says he saw similar conflicts in police departments and other workplaces boil over after the shooting of unarmed teenager Michael Brown in Ferguson last summer.
People were coming right off the street the night before, being out in a protest and then working side by side with somebody, and the energy from the protest got brought right into the workplace.
Allison Manswell is also a diversity consultant and author of Listen In, a book about racial conversations in the workplace. She agrees heightened tension is finding inappropriate expression in the form of slurs, fights, or surly online posts.
There are some workplaces where the culture and the environment was already prone to this, so they have got their hands full right now. I can tell you that with absolute certainty.
But, Manswell says, the answer isn't to quash discussion. She argues it should be encouraged in a mediated forum. Coworkers should offer each other mutual support, she argues, comparing the shootings to other fatal disasters.
What's been happening around police brutality is a tsunami in the African American community. How might it feel for all coworkers to come to work the next day and to not acknowledge that there was a tsunami?
Manswell lives in Baltimore, where today a third police officer was acquitted, but three others still face charges in last year's death of Freddie Gray. She mediated a discussion between coworkers who shared their feelings about race.
The conversation was difficult. There were tears. I mean, literally, there were people in tears. But there was this high degree of understanding that came out of it at the end that was so worth it for everyone.
Kentonius Gill, the network administrator, agrees. He says his conversation with his white colleague helped.
We haven't spoken about it since, but I'm not tense. I hope she's not.
Relieving that tension, he says, is the path to restoring civility.
These things definitely warrant discussion because, I mean, right now we are reeling. These things can't be set aside. They're not going to heal themselves.
Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Context of white supremacy, Gus T. Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Wednesday, October 19th, 2016. So I have been told. I haven't been able to check the news as vigorously as I would like. We've been broadcasting, I think this is our 10th consecutive day doing a program. But I checked the New York Times before we went on, and the report they have on Haiti, this is just days after, you know, 1,000 black people at least died from Hurricane Matthew in Haiti. But the article they have on the New York Times, Haitian warlord meets his match, Hurricane Matthew. And the description, it reads, the storm has done what neither government nor armed forces have managed to accomplish, bring Guy Philippe to his knees as his community starves. This is the sort of reporting that we get days after 1,000 minimum black people perish in Haiti from Hurricane Matthew. Always important keeping an eye on the news. Anyway, our program for today, we got from checking the news back this summer, right in the middle of the shootings that happened in Louisiana, Minnesota, and then Texas, where the five enforcement officers were shot and killed. They had this report at NPR, and certainly anyone who has listened to the Cows over the years certainly has heard me talk about the importance of having dialogue about workplace racism, that this is just a mammoth problem for us, and a variety of ways worldwide. We've had a lot of programs where we've talked about workplace racism, and we have a weekly segment exclusively devoted to workplace racism every Thursday. I've been saying since last week we get two doses of workplace racism this week, and in my view, it's totally warranted. There needs to be more scholarship, more information, just because so many black people really struggle in this area, labor. Our guest for the program this evening, her book was mentioned in that report. It is Listen In, Crucial Conversations on Race in the Workplace, where it kind of gives a lot of different examples, suggestions for dealing with racism on the job. In addition to having written this book, our guest is a dynamic life coach, gifted motivational speaker, and author. In addition to all that, she is a black mother. Real pleasure to have her with us on the program this evening, our guest, Ms. Allison Manswell. Ms. Manswell, you with us?
Yes, Gus, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for a wonderful introduction. You're right, that is probably the most important part of my introduction, that I am a black mother.
Right on. I dig. The black mothers are super important, for sure. Anything that you think would be important? I know this might be some of our listeners' first time hearing from you and hearing about your book. Anything that you'd like listeners to know about who you are, the work that you do?
Yes, I think the most important thing is that this is about the second time that my professional expertise has collided with my soul's work. And this whole notion of writing a book on race in the workplace, it doesn't just come from the fact that I am a mother and that I care deeply about what's going on in the workplace for the students and the young people coming up in the workplace, for those of us who are already here now. But it has to do with the fact that I have some expertise in this area. I've been working in human resources in the United States for about 18 years now. And during that time, I've come to a few conclusions about the problems we're experiencing, and I have some ideas about solutions. But I think the most important thing is to know that this is a situation where my professional expertise has collided with what's important to me in my heart, and this book is a scholarly work that comes from a place of passion.
You can get the book and get more information for Allison Manswell. Go to her website, www.allisonmanswell.com. It's linked in the description for the broadcast. That address again, www.allisonmanswell.com. Where were you born, Ms. Manswell?
I was actually born and raised in Canada.
Wow, okay, okay. What part of Canada?
Montreal, Quebec. Born and raised in a Caribbean family. And then I came to the United States when I got married probably about 25 years ago, and I've been here ever since.
Okay.
I think what's important, though, is that I still experience the United States very much as an observer. So when people ask me where I'm from, I still say Canada because there's a large part of me that is still very Canadian and non-American, and it allows me to observe what's going on in the country as a scholar.
Okay. Interesting. How do you classify yourself racially? Like when people ask that question, what do you generally say?
Oh, African-American. I have no problem classifying myself as African-American. Actually, my father's side of the family is Ghanaian, so I am actually African-American, not in the typical definition of it, but I am very proud to identify as African-American.
Okay. And is your husband, was he born in the States, or is he Canadian, or?
So my ex-husband at this point was actually born in the Caribbean as well.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. This program, and you have pictures on your website if anyone is curious. If you want to check out our guest, AllisonManswell.com, you can see photographs as well. This program, Context of White Supremacy, I use the word racism and the term white supremacy. I use them as synonyms, and I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
I do. I think that there is definitely systemic racism that shows its ugly head in so many different places that it would be difficult for someone to deny the definition.
Right on. Again, the book, Listen In, Crucial Conversations on Race in the Workplace. Why is it titled Listen In?
That's interesting. So two reasons. Number one, because the book is written, first of all, it's written as a fictional novel where the reader is literally listening in to a series of conversations that we otherwise may not be privy to. So you are actually, as you're reading, you're listening in to, as sort of in a fishbowl type way, listening into these conversations.
That caught me off guard a tad. I was not expecting a book on workplace racism to be kind of fictional vignettes where you're just kind of hearing different dialogues, different conversations from white people, black people, just hearing different folks' conversations about workplace racism. What was your thinking about that, talking about this subject matter in a fictional format?
Yeah, so the rationale was because
I had a choice, right? Based on my expertise and my years in the workplace, I could have written a textbook-type work. However, I don't believe that we are lacking data. There is an overabundance of data that exists. There are tons of agencies, organizations, associations that publish report after report, year after year, and that data has been out in the marketplace for years and years and has not moved the needle on what we're trying to solve for. So therefore, data is not what we're lacking. What we lack is insight. And I know, based on my work in adult learning, that adults learn through storytelling. And so therefore, I thought if I could have a story that was embedded with the real-life types of scenarios that myself, my colleagues, my friends, my family members have experienced, I could engage someone in the story, I could teach through the story, and then I could prolong the learning because I could have them have their own awarenesses, make their own personal connections through these, air quote, fictional characters. In addition, this format gave me the opportunity to write two books in one. So on the one hand, we have five African-American friends who meet for drinks after work from time to time, and they talk about their experiences in their respective workplaces. And through that dialogue, we can hear at least five different views of what's going on in the workplace. We hear different perspectives. We have characters who disagree. And that allows me to tell both sides of the story. For example, there's one character who, gets a little annoyed that every time we get together, you guys always want to talk about race. Everything isn't about race. And then you have her colleague who says, it's not that we have to talk about race. It's just so funny how when we talk about our workplaces, race just happens to come up. And then throughout the story, you have that same character has a series of experiences where she comes to understand some things that she wouldn't have understood before. So on the one half of the book, you have African-American characters who are sharing insights. And for a white reader, these are insights that they would not get in any other venue because these are conversations that they would otherwise not be privy to. So that's the learning that's happening there. It just so happens in one of the early chapters that a white CEO overhears them talking. Specifically, they're talking about the issue of hair, black women's hair in the workplace. And he gets very curious about this experience of race that he's never thought of in this way. And he launches an investigation into his own company around what is really going on with regard to race inside his organization. And that part of the book provides some very necessary business consulting where a leader, a human resource executive, a diversity executive, a CEO can then use that character's storyline to effect change inside their organization. Because basically what I do is I provide free consulting through that storyline to show organizations what they can do to make a difference. So that's the overall framework of the book, and that's how I use the notion of fiction to accomplish two purposes with one very small, readable book.
I see. So two quick questions. The white male that kind of overhears this conversation where these black people are talking about racism, workplace racism. Is this white character who kind of overhears this and kind of takes some of these ideas and implements them, is this based on any actual true experience? Is this a composite of some sort?
Yes, absolutely. So all of the characters are a composite of some sort. They are all the sum total, cumulative total of my experiences, whether personally or professionally. So the character and the path that he takes, as well as the solutions that he employs, are actually proven strategies that I have either been part of implementing myself in an organization or things that I have seen work in organizations.
Oh, okay. Is it I guess the aspect of him over here, like the things that he implements and what have you, I get that you've seen that. But in terms of like an actual white person overhearing some black people have this sort of discussion, is that in the fiction realm, or is that kind of connected to something that did happen?
The actual part of the overhearing, I think that's part of just in my fiction imagination in terms of how would this need to happen? And it's a great question. I don't think I've ever been asked that before. I think that's from the realm of just my imagination, because I feel as if somebody would have to have a real... No, that's not true. There are CEOs who are enlightened enough to launch this kind of work, to be sincere and to be committed to outcomes, to just do this on their own. And there are other CEOs and other executives and leaders in positions of influence who would have to have this type of very personal, random, spontaneous experience to be moved to action.
Okay. And the other quick question was your intended audience. Who were you thinking were going to be the readers of Listen In? Did you intend for white people to read it, black people, everybody?
Yes and yes and yes. So okay. I wanted the book to be useful for everybody, but I also was very comfortable in having a book that was a very narrow focus. So it's a very wide target audience, but it's a very narrowly focused book. So, for example, I had a colleague challenge me early on when I was writing and releasing the book, and she said, well, you know, Allison, with all of your vast experiences, why didn't you make the characters a diverse group? You know, why did they have to be all African-American? My response was, this is a book about race in the workplace that is very narrowly focused on the African-American experience, and the book is about five African-American characters. Thank you for sharing. So I was very deliberate about the narrow focus that, with regard to race, the grouping of African-Americans is obviously not the only grouping that is experiencing challenges around race in the workplace. However, they are the group that I happen to have the most insight about, I happen to have the most expertise about, and quite frankly, they're the group that's worth paying for my opinion. If I felt like I had that kind of insight about other racial groups, or if at any time in the future I feel like I have that insight, I will write that book. But for right now, I feel that it is very worthwhile to spend time, energy, and money to solve for probably one of the most prevalent, pervasive elements of diversity that we have, and that is race with regard to African Americans in the workplace. So it's a very narrowly focused book with a very broad target audience.
Just want to insert, I commend you for making this exclusively focused on this group of black people and not bending to that pressure. I think that's an act of black self-respect, as Dr. Frances Cress Welsing would say. And I think that sort of thing happens a lot, where we get discouraged from having something that focuses on black people and saying, oh, you should have, you know, other folks in the project somehow. So definitely appreciate that. In the subtitle of the book, so the subtitle is Crucial Conversations on Race in the Workplace. Why did you go with the term race as opposed to racism?
Yes, because when I think about the elements of diversity, and once again, it is a very narrow focus on race. The term racism, the book itself can be interpreted as being about racism. The experience that I write about is about how race, specifically being African American, is experienced in the workplace. And, you know, there's a portion of this, and I have actually experienced, there are a vast majority of non-black people in the workplace who I don't think they wake up every morning going to work with the intention to be racist. I'm not certain that I'm willing to say everybody wakes up in the morning with the intention to be racist when they go to work. I do believe that they have been a part of this system that you mentioned before that has this very strong programming power that has taught them to behave a certain way, to believe a certain way, to look at the world a certain way, and to walk through the earth somewhat oblivious and to sort of just experience the world from their own lens only. And so what I wanted to show was that this whole notion of race is not based on if someone intends to be racist or not. I frankly don't care that much about people's intentions. What I want people to focus on is the impact of their behavior. This is not kindergarten. In kindergarten, you learn that if you, you know, are wiggling in your seat and you hit your neighbor, that you say sorry, and the very act of saying I'm sorry makes it all better. Well, that's for kindergarten. When we get to be grown adults, you are responsible for your impact in addition to your intention. So whereas you didn't intend to be racist, you are responsible for having had the impact of disparate impact against people who are people of color. And what I wanted to do was focus the book on the impact that these behaviors have without distracting people by trying to call people racist. Does that make sense?
I understand. I wanted to ask what do you mean when you say race, just so I can get the distinction. But before I get your response, I wanted to encourage listeners to dial in. If you have questions, I know we have a lot of folks who dial in for workplace racism. If you have questions that you'd like to hear some of Allison Manswell's thoughts, her suggestions on the topic matter, dial in. The number is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you have a question, and we'll go to the phone lines early so that people can dial in. And if you have something you'd like to hear her thoughts, Dial in. So, Ms. Manswell, what do you mean when you use the term race?
I use the term race as the distinguishing factor for how we identify ourselves, you know, in those categories. Race: are you Caucasian, African American, Hispanic? Those ethnic distinguishers that we use. That's how I use the term race.
Okay. I'm just looking at the title and thinking about what I read in the book. To me, it almost seems like racism would have been the more accurate term, because it seems like that's what the book is talking about, the different ways that racism impacts Black people specifically in the workplace. Is that an inaccurate interpretation or?
No, not at all. I mean, there is no denying that. Racism rears its ugly head in the workplace, and the scenarios that you hear the characters talk about, the types of examples that they provide, and frankly, even the solutions that I offer, they could just as easily be applied to racism. But I think that my rationale for the wording was the fact that I want to encourage people. First of all, these are crucial. Like, I tried so many different words besides crucial. You know, I had a whole list of other words, and I landed on crucial because this is an emergency situation. We need to start talking about what is going on with regard to race in the workplace, because we can't solve for anything that we don't talk about. And I'm sure you have another line of questions for me that's related to how I handle police brutality in the book. But this whole notion that our community is under siege, we are in an emergency situation. So these are crucial conversations that have to occur on race, and they have to occur in the workplace, because we have avoided these conversations. We have pussyfooted and farted around
with these, you know, issues, and we need to start talking about them. So I'm up for some conversations that are just like direct and straight, and I recognize we don't know how to do this. So I decided to write a book that would help people with the how.
Wow. Make it plain. Make it plain.
I hope my listeners aren't offended by my words, but I don't know how else to explain. This is an emergency situation.
I agree 1,000%. Absolutely. I do have questions about that. You have an exchange with one of your characters, LaToya, where she's talking to a white woman. They're talking about this project at work, and she goes specifically to some of the issues that you talked about. This is on page 21. Silence is a Statement is the chapter. LaToya took a deep breath and softly replied, "That Freddie Gray thing that you just referenced is actually a pretty big life or death issue to those who feel at risk of police brutality. By the way, that's 28% of our employee base, and although they are predominantly at the bottom of our ranks, their labor generates the lion's share of our revenue. That sounds like a pretty significant stakeholder group to me. I can't help but mention how uncomfortable it feels for me to hear you refer to it as a thing. It's an issue. It's a big issue. Black Lives Matter." And their exchange kind of goes on where this white woman listens to some of her concerns. And you think these type of conversations, it's important that they are happening on the job between non-white people and white people?
Absolutely. So that is just one example of an exchange. So it happens in the context of one of the African American characters talking to a white coworker, and in the conversation, just as you mentioned, she happens to say that Freddie Gray thing, and it's a very direct way for her to correct someone who, once again, unintentional in terms of her language and choice of words, but she's able to make the point that the language is not acceptable and it makes me uncomfortable. And so this, the problem with some of what happens when people are on both sides of Black Lives Matter and then they take liberty to replace it with All Lives Matter is because we're not clear in what we mean when we say certain words. And until we become comfortable with saying that something makes me uncomfortable and, you know, the way you phrase that just doesn't sit well with me, those kinds of conversations need to happen. Now, keep in mind, the nature of the relationship between these two characters had her to say this in a particular way that allowed her to be very direct. I'm not suggesting that this would be the exact same way you would use it with in every context of every conversation, but it is pretty effective in the context of this situation. And I love that you mentioned the chapter that this fits in, because that is actually one of my favorite chapters in the book. It's called Silence is a Statement. And I say that, I use that phrase often, because on both sides, whether it's non-white people or it's white people, when we say nothing about issues that are life and death issues for other people, sometimes we believe that if I say nothing, I'm just being safe because I don't want to get involved. And we don't realize that when you are the person in the impacted group and you are a person of color, we actually hear silence. And that silence can be louder than words. And sometimes you're being held accountable for the silence that you held on an issue.
Absolutely. I think Dr. King made similar remarks about the folks who do not do anything in the face of injustice, racism frequently. What would your response be to, I'm sure there are a lot, particularly a lot of black people who would say, you know, "Hey, Allison, that's all good and well. I'm in a work environment where my white coworkers, they are not interested in having a no pussyfooting conversation about racism, and they are not interested in hearing me challenge their views or statements on racism. And in fact, if I do such a thing, I could be putting my very job in jeopardy. What would your response be?
You know what? I focused the entire introduction on that very issue. So one of the things I wanted to do in the introduction was to set my intentions for this book very clearly. And there's a couple things. There's actually several disclaimers in the front of the book. First of all, I am not suggesting by any stretch of the imagination that every individual in every workplace should engage in crucial conversations. In fact, I offer four disclaimers. If you look on, it's page 11 of the introduction in Roman numeral 11, I talk about four disclaimers of who should not talk about race in the workplace. We can go over each of them if you'd like. But in addition to giving disclaimers about who should not talk about race in the workplace, I also mention in the book, everybody should be as much of a change agent as your checkbook allows you to be, right? I am not suggesting anybody put their family's livelihood at risk to run out in the workplace and be a change champion and start having conversations about race. By all means, be as much of a change agent as your checkbook allows you to be. At this stage in my career, I am extraordinarily blessed to be able to have gotten to the place where I was willing to spend the career capital to write this kind of book and to be this kind of change agent, but I am not suggesting that anybody jeopardize their livelihood to do what I've done. I simply am suggesting that I've created a tool that for those who are willing, who are operating in a workplace that is ready, and they are able, that this is a tool that can be used. So I give other advice in the book as well about how African Americans can understand their culture and understand how to navigate within it.
For your fourth disclaimer, you do write that not everyone should engage in conversations about race at work. And you state that in some instances it would be best to politely excuse yourself when these sort of conversations are going up if you don't think it's going to be constructive. Do you have any lines? Because I know for some people that can be difficult, figuring out a way to politely excuse yourself. Like, do you have a sentence or a line that you kind of recommend people using to politely exit?
Oh, yeah. I have them at the tip of my tongue. You know, there's a blank stare. You know, there's when someone is trying to engage me in a conversation, that a couple of things happen. They might have a position that I recognize is so diametrically opposed to mine that the likelihood of us meeting in the middle is very slim. Therefore, that conversation might not be a good use of my time or, frankly, more importantly, my emotional energy. I am a snob about my emotional energy. And if I find that this is a conversation with somebody who is not my equal, frankly, not my intellectual equal, I won't engage in the conversation, and I will say, I'm not sure that we can make any headway in this conversation, so I'm going to leave you with your own ideas. Or I will simply say, you know, it's possible that because of my perspective, because of my lived experience, I have a perspective that is so far away from you, we don't have enough time for us to meet in the middle. And you know, I guess I'm full of one-liners, so it depends on the severity of their opinion. It depends on the context. It depends on the nature of the relationship. I always want to leave that other person intact. I am very rarely blatantly disrespectful unless I have potentially been disrespected. But even so, I'm the consummate, you know, gracious ambassador who wants to leave the conversation with a person feeling whole, but I also do not get baited into conversations that won't yield any intellectual value.
Mm-hmm. I think it's very important for Black people on the job to make that assessment when the conversation, you can already see that this is not going to yield a constructive result for you. Politely exit the dialogue. And,
yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, sometimes the exit is my statement, right? So that's sometimes my silence is my statement. I have had times where I have simply picked up my handbag and left a meeting. Mm. And my silence and my departure was all the statement I needed to make.
Mm.
I gathered my things, I picked up my handbag, and I left.
Right on. Black self-respect again. You move through the book, and this is in the same chapter, Silence is a Statement, where you start with the group of five different black people, males and females, and they're giving their experience. And so this white male, he overhears the conversation, and so we end up following him as well, he and his wife, Susan, Jim and Susan. And so they have a conversation kind of in their bedroom or at once they've got home or what have you. This is the white woman, Susan, white man, Jim. And Susan is talking about, oh, man, I offered this position to LaToya. And she kind of spoke plainly, no pussyfooting, about her views on things. And it wasn't really what I was expecting. And she kind of turned down the position. And her husband kind of agrees with what she shared. She said, oh, that's great. You know, you got constructive information. And so her husband, he moves forward and he says, I've shifted the way I see a lot of these issues. I have engaged my leadership team in real dialogue, and I'm pushing them to think about our approaches differently. Ultimately, I'm going to hold them accountable for different results, but dialogue is the first step. I've started following a few African-American thought leaders on Twitter. Roland Martin, for example. I like how he understands corporate challenges and holds people accountable. On one of his TV shows, they address the fact that people often bring up black-on-black crime as if it justifies police brutality. It doesn't. And he goes on. They continue with their exchange. And I thought, wow, I know this is fiction, but I don't know how many white people are following like Roland Martin or other black folks on Twitter to see what their views are on racism or what black people think. Like, is this a composite as well?
Well, you know, that's actually a real life experience where I made that recommendation. I was assigned as the executive coach for a CEO of a major corporation. And in my coaching, one of the experiences, I create learning experiences, right? So one of the experiences I created for him was to follow several thought leaders. And Roland Martin happened to be one of them. So I have actually used that as one of my coaching techniques. It's a wonderful way to provide insight in this day and age where we have social media and technology as a tool.
They just had a report within the last month about how white people, they do not talk about racism, at least they said, in their social media feeds. And they tend to be kind of insulated from people like Roland Martin and other black people that, you know, talk about racism or share their thoughts on these sort of views. Do you think that's typical? Do you think that's representative of the typical white person that they're following and listening to a Roland Martin or Melissa Harris Perry or somebody like that?
No, actually, I don't think they are, which is why, you know, having them to start do it, it can be so powerful because I think all of us, we're all a product of our Facebook feed, right? So we're all a product of the universe that we normally operate in. And just as I offer that as a solution, I try to make sure that I'm following other thought leaders who don't look like me so that there's parts of insight that I could gain from them and learn from them as well. One of the things I should mention is that Howard Roth, who is a phenomenal thought leader in the area of unconscious bias, he's an advocate for many issues around race and gender, is a white male, and his thought leadership is incredible. He wrote the afterword to the book. He's a very good friend of mine, and I actually work with his organization, but he is not necessarily the profile of someone that you would think of in this area, but definitely his thought leadership, maybe because it is very closely aligned to mine. There are other people that I follow or that I listen to them. From time to time, I tune into various news networks just for as much as I can stomach it, to get whatever little perspectives I can, and just to hear, you know, what's going on. And I think that that's a way to stay well-rounded and current.
Hmm. Wow. You said in your response, and it's in the book in quite a few places, the notion of unconscious bias or being unaware, not knowing that you are practicing racism. We just had a white woman on the program 2 days ago, Mary Beth Gassman, and she was talking about the ways that white faculty members at white institutions, colleges, universities, ways that they deliberately keep black faculty members from being hired. And she said that whites know that they are doing this, and they have codified words that they use when they go into these sessions that, oh, this person is not qualified, or they don't have the right pedigree. They wouldn't be a good fit. She went into all these different, and not only that, she got thousands of comments, many of them from whites, who said, oh yeah, we do that. I do that. That's what we do too. That's how we keep from hiring black people. And I just cite that as one example. I think that is one of the common misnomers about racism, this notion that whites are unaware. I think they're very aware. In fact, I don't think you can be a white man, white woman, white child, and be ignorant about how you're supposed to function as a white person as it relates to racism. What are your thoughts?
So I understand the notion of unconscious bias. I think that there is some part of this that is unconscious, meaning that it is so ingrained in our culture. It begins when you are a child, you're growing up, you're learning how to count American dollar bills, and you see only white males on the money. You begin to get a message about who you are in this world relative to other people. And there is a segment of this that is absolutely unconscious. I do believe that. There is, however, I am not willing to let anybody off the hook for the elements and the parts of this that are absolutely conscious. And I think that there are behaviors that are pervasive. There are trends that continue for long periods of time. There are codified ways of behaving that are absolutely conscious. And so, yes, I think that I am more on the side of being able, I can make a list of the behaviors that I think are unconscious, and I can make a similar list of things that I believe are absolutely conscious. And in general, I do not believe that this issue of race in the workplace, when we become ready to solve for it, we will. But I am thinking we're probably not ready to solve for it yet, which is why we still have it as an issue. And I am, you know, I'm hoping that I can be part of the solution to help us be ready. Or, ready or not, here we come. We need to solve for this. When enough people start talking about it, we can move the needle and get organizations to address this issue. So I think it's a combination of both. I think that there are some behaviors that are unconscious. I don't know. I have not gotten to a place of cynicism yet where I believe all white people behave in a way that are out to get us. I'm not of that mindset.
Oh, okay, right on. I would have two quick questions. I do see we have folks that called in. I guess, number one, you said if there were two lists, right, you had your one list, these are unconscious ways that individuals classified as white practice racism, and these are conscious ways that they do so. Which list is longer?
That's a great question. Which list is longer? I don't know. I'd have to think about that.
Okay.
We'll
give you a little time, Ms. Manswell, and see. We'll come back a little later and see if you have an idea. The other question,
okay.
You said you're not at a place of cynicism. You don't think that everyone who classifies as white is practicing racism. Have you figured out a fail-proof system of picking out which white people are racist and which ones are not?
Oh, boy. I don't think my system, no, I don't know that my system was any more accurate than figuring out, you know, which Black people are truly my allies and which ones are jealous and envious of me, right? So I don't think that, I don't have a foolproof system to figure that out either. But I will say that I approach, this is my new approach to life. It's taken me a while to get here. But I have come to the conclusion that I don't interact with anybody as the relationship says we are. And I figured this out using family members, for example. So I don't relate to people just because, you know, this experience says that you and I came to this world and we are brother and sister. That does not mean that we are going to get along perfectly and that we are going to have this beautifully loving and warm relationship. There's the possibility that we come to this earth as brother and sister, and there is this weird energy between us where we don't get along. And maybe there is some jealousy and some rivalry, and you believe that, you know, our dad favored me over you, and you've always experienced your role in the family as, like, subordinate, and you think, everybody thinks Allison is better than me. And you just have this thing where you feel like I've been treated better than you in the family. And then I have this thing, let's say, where I just feel like you're like a spoiled little brat and you just think the world should be handed to you. And as a result of how you think about me and I think about you, we don't get along. I have come to the conclusion that just because we come to this earth as blood relatives does not mean that we have a loving and warm energy between us. And so I take the same mode of thinking out into the workplace and out into my other relationships. And I say, I treat people based on who my soul says they are. If my soul tells me that this person is a good soul, that they have good intentions for me, that they are able to see me for who I am without a filter of race, that they are able to listen to me with the lens of just intellectual curiosity, if my soul tells me that this person who may be white is coming to me with a good spirit, I am going to interact with that person as if they are a really good person. And I might even be able to, I will be able to overlook, you know, the racial package that they come in simply because they interact with me and my soul tells me they are a friend and not a foe. And by the same token, if I interact with someone and my soul tells me that there is some weird energy, that there is some negative something that, I don't know, there's a bad vibe I get from that person, I will interact with that person as if they are a foe, regardless of the package they come in, and even if they come in a package that's wrapped in being a Black person.
Mm-hmm. Context of White Supremacy, our guest, Allison Manswell, her book, Listen In, that's what we're discussing this evening. You can get more information at her website, AllisonManswell.com, AllisonManswell.com, linked in the description. Metaphors, wowee. Metaphors. One more question before I get to some of our listeners who dialed in. On page 27, you discuss some of the other members of the book, same chapter, Silence is a Statement, where you have some of the group has broken down. So this is Nathan and Elijah. Nathan is one of the members of the group.
Okay, let me stop you. Because you're about to do a spoiler. You're about to do a spoiler alert. And so that particular part of the book is one of the surprises that I want to keep for our readers. Do you want to ask me specifically about Nathan and Eli?
I can. I feel like I would still give it away if I ask my question. Let's see. I don't know. Let me answer
the question I won't let you ask. How about that?
Go ahead.
So one of the things I wanted to do in the book was to address
different facets of what goes on in our community. And there was a part in the book where, well, actually, before I started the book, I had a pretty good outline of who each of the characters were, what their profile was, and what was the value they brought to the conversation. And I didn't really have any intention to go off script. And this is how I know that this book really comes from a divine place, because somewhere along the line in writing the book, I found out a secret about one of the characters that I myself did not know, and I wrote the secret into the book. And so the only thing I would like is that the secret remains intact, so that when people read the book, they experience it almost the same way I did, and they are as shocked by it as I was when I was writing it, because literally I was as shocked when I was writing it.
Hmm. Okay. still, man, that's a pretty important question. That's all I can say for listeners. That was a pretty important question to not get to. I will take.
Why don't you ask me the question? Why don't you ask me the question without telling us about the characters?
I mean, I could not mention the characters, but just based on the question, I think people would pretty much figure it out. So there's no way I can really do it. The people that dialed in who have a question, if you have something in workplace racism related, that would be my preference. I don't know that it's mandatory. It's got to be that, but that would be the preference that we're. Not kind of all over the place. Let's see, folks that dialed in, the caller at 1580. Did you have a question for Allison Manswell?
Yes, this is Stephanie. Thank you, Allison, for being on the show. Thank you, Gus T. Renegade, for presenting the show. I actually had two questions, if I could ask them. The first one is related to earlier in the show, like near the beginning, and the second one is more recent, and it's a shorter question, if I could get that one out quick.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so the first question was when she was saying that she doesn't inherently believe that white people wake up every morning with the intent that I'm out to get black people. But, and I don't want to say that they do, but do you think that indifference is the same crime? Because even if they are not deliberately waking up out to get us, do you think that there is any empathy or they care if we get got by the system of white supremacy?
That's a great question. And I would say that that's the whole reason behind the chapter around silence is a statement. I am a very big believer in that people, if you want me to believe that you are a good person and that you care about this, then I fully expect you to use your voice in service of what's going on. I do get very concerned about the lack of national outcry that I hear about police brutality. I get concerned when I hear people say, well, you know, I don't really have anything to say about that. I get concerned about that, and it rubs me the wrong way, quite frankly, because I feel like when there are other crises that happen, and I used the tsunami in the NPR interview as an example, because when we have a national disaster that happens to a group other than our own, it is very easy for us to spring into action and say, let's pray for France. You don't have to be from France, but your neural connectors that provide, that give you empathy, allow you to display empathy for another group. And I expect the same thing to be true when something happens to the African-American community. So in answer to your question, I actually am very much for holding people accountable and expecting that people will care deeply about what's happening in our community.
Okay. I'm not sure it still seems like I would rather the indifference. I prefer the indifference than the what I quote unquote call the white affect. I don't want you to pretend to care for the sake of my feelings. I'd rather you be honest. So, you know, because we get the white affect. We get
you
it from politicians.
You said you had another question? I just want to try to get this.
Yes, next question. I'm sorry. I was thinking about when you said the fact that you wrote the book as a fictional book. Did you write it as a fictional book kind of as like a backdoor safety clause, I was thinking? Have you thought of that perspective, like maybe to counteract repercussions from like the dominant system, kind of like the white people can talk about white people, but black people can't?
No, I don't think so. I've thought about this. I've had a lot of time to think about what kind of book am I going to write. And I just didn't want to write the textbook type book because I don't feel that we lack data. I just didn't want to. However, I included a lot of that research in the book. You'll find that there is a lot of research embedded as resources, but they're written into the story. And let me just tell you, at this point in my career, maybe over drinks or something, I'll tell you about how my career has actually changed dramatically since writing this book. There probably are a lot of people who are not that pleased that I wrote it. Because of my degree of expertise, it can be considered a whistleblower's book. But again, I've been blessed to be at a place in my career where I frankly don't need to be concerned about that. My faith also tells me that when you do the right thing, what's yours is yours, is always yours in the universe. So I'm very proud to not be at a stage where I need to worry about that too much.
Okay. And I didn't want you to be offended by that question. It's just as a writer myself, I was thinking of writing a speculative fiction for that reason. And thank you so much for answering my questions, and thank you, Gus.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're welcome. And if you please remember, you can always write a book under a pen name. And that was an option for me as well, but that's not something I wanted to do also. So just, it's an option for you if you think about it.
Right on. Thomas in New York, did you have a question? Thomas in New York.
I have 2.5 questions, Gus. Is that okay?
Let's hear it.
Okay, I want to hear the half question.
My first question is not related to your workplace racism. I just want to know if you can give us one example of unconscious bias that white people display, just one example.
Okay, sure. This is a pretty cliche example, but it's the first one that comes to my mind. So someone like me who does training, I do speaking, I'm very often at the front of the room. At the end of a session, a white person may come up to me and say, "Oh my gosh, Allison, that was wonderful. I so enjoyed that. You are so articulate." Now, in their mind, that phrase is a compliment that is intended to say that I did a great job and that I speak very well. Now, it does not land to me as a compliment because my first thought is, this is what I do for a living. Why would anybody put me at the front of the room if I was not articulate and able to communicate? What I feel like you're really responding to is that you have this vision in your mind of African Americans who don't speak well, maybe not intelligent, and when you meet and experience one who is, it occurs to you as I'm articulate as if I'm the exception to my group's rule. And so to me, that occurs as unconscious bias. There's a bias in your mind against African Americans being speaking well and being articulate. And so it comes out unconsciously as a compliment when you call me articulate. So that's the example I would give you.
Interesting. Thanks for your example. My second question is, I just started a job Monday, and
congratulations.
Well, thank you. It's at a hospital, and I'm working with a very diverse staff, but none of the people are white, and the management is all Latino, and I noticed that amongst the Latino people, they speak Spanish. The manager keeps apologizing, but she at the same time says, you know, that's what, it's more comfortable for me to speak that language to them. And I just wanted to know what would be your thoughts in dealing with something like that.
Sure. Okay, so that's a great question. I'm sorry, tell me where it is you work. I think I missed the context of the company.
Hospital.
A hospital, okay. So here's the way I would approach this. I would get on the job and just engage in the process of learning as much as you can. And I would probably say to the supervisor that, you know, being new, I am very much interested in learning as much as I can. It's difficult for me when you're speaking in Spanish to them and everybody's having this conversation in Spanish that I don't understand. I totally recognize that that is more comfortable for them, but how would you recommend that I speed up my orientation process and kind of catch up on what I'm missing in the language barrier? And ask her for suggestions on how you can catch up on whatever it is that you're missing based on this language barrier. And that puts the onus on her to help you think through solutions.
Well, thank you for that. That's a really good technique, though. My half a question was, Gus asked you, if you had a foolproof, have you figured out a foolproof way to figure out which white people are racist or not? And you kind of, in your answer, you diverted and you started talking about issues you have with black people, their jealousy and things. I just wanted to know if you could answer this question with a yes or no. And that's my last question. Thank you.
Sure. So the answer to the question then is no. When you say foolproof way to find out, you know, which white people are racist and which are not, no, I don't have a foolproof way to do that. And I wouldn't say that I diverted my answer. I used my example to say I don't think there is a foolproof way to know, you know, if somebody is friend or foe. If I knew that, I'd write a relationship book and make way more money than, you know, the book I have made. I just don't think that there is a foolproof way to know that.
Right on. Our caller in Michigan, did you have a question for Ms. Allison Manswell?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus, and to the guest. I have three questions, if I may. The first question is, do you have any suggestions on how to handle or respond to the common reaction that I find from white people, especially white women, to black women's hair? I find that they always find it necessary to make comments. It's not necessarily compliments, but just always making just unnecessary comments about our hair.
That's a very good question. As a matter of fact, I addressed the issue of hair in chapter one because it's such a thing. So my suggestion, and I'm saying this as somebody who has worn my hair in all different hairstyles, I go back and forth between relaxer and braids, depending on what kind of mood I'm in, and quite frankly, depending on what's going on in my career. What I would say is if you work with a number of people who consistently make comments about your hair that make you uncomfortable, I would handle it the way I would handle anything else, with really a frank, honest response that says, while I understand your fascination with my hair, I understand that it might be something you're curious about, I just want to let you know that when you consistently comment on it, it makes me uncomfortable. And what I would prefer is if you have like a last two or three questions that you want to ask me about my hair, go ahead and ask me now, and then just assume that from henceforth, I will do all kinds of different things with my hair, and you don't need to understand every choice I make about my hair. That would be, okay, you know, one of the frank conversations I would have with people, you know, with an inordinate amount of questions.
Great, thanks. The second question, Starbucks had a campaign last year or some kind of initiative where they encouraged their employees to discuss race and racism, I believe. And to my knowledge, it wasn't as effective, I guess, as they had thought it would be. I don't know what they were hoping to gain from that, but are you familiar with the campaign, and do you think it was effective, or what are your thoughts on that?
I'm not sure which specific campaign you're talking about, but here's my thoughts on random, unstructured conversations about race. I don't believe in them, and that's hence the disclaimers I give at the beginning of the book. I don't believe that you should just send people out willy-nilly to talk about race, because the history and context of race in America is so strong, so deep, the implications are so intense that I don't think it should be just unstructured conversations. I actually believe that there are some workplaces that should be having mediated conversations on race, because people need an usher to introduce this conversation. People need a mediator, and they need a skilled facilitator to bring both sides together and have people leaving feeling whole. If you just say that at your workplace, go, you know, stand at the water cooler and talk about race, I don't think that that will lead to productive conversation, because people's views are so diametrically opposed, it won't necessarily leave room for dialogue and then understanding. So I don't agree with that strategy. I think these should be facilitated conversations, but I do believe you can create an environment where people build trust between themselves and they can have those conversations. I also think that as African Americans, we need better language, and I love the opportunities that this interview has given to kind of share some of that language. You don't have to use my words, but we do need to kind of think through the language we might use of how to talk about certain things. And I also think that white people need to think this through as well. They need to think about some of the questions that they ask, and they also need to think about who has the burden of the answer, right? So I shouldn't always have the burden to educate in the workplace. Some of that burden should be on white people as well. Go read something. Go learn something. Go to a website you've never been to before. Go and gain some insight before you come to me with a question that is going to cause me emotional harm. So I think that's a twofold responsibility, but once again, we have to open up the conversation first to be able to get to those levels of pre-work.
Before you get your last question in, Ms. Manswell, your audio kind of went up and down a little bit. I don't know if you moved the distance from your phone or if you have a headset on or what have you, but it fluctuated a little bit. I just wanted to make sure we had you kind of steady and crystal so we can hear you well.
Oh, okay. Thank you for letting me know. I'm sorry about that. I'm hoping this is better.
Sounds stable thus far. Well, I'll let you know if it changes, but you sound good there. Caller in Michigan, proceed.
Yeah, so my final thanks for answering that question. And my final question is, is, in your opinion, who is most confused or ignorant about racism, what it is, and how it works, and why? Black people or white people or non-white people?
Who is most confused? Now, I think white people are most confused, because unfortunately, as black people, we are quite clear about how racism works, about how it affects us, about what's the impact of decisions, about where race is operating, and people think it's not. So unfortunately, because we are the most impacted, we are very clear. For the most part, we are clear. I'm also going to say sometimes we are wrong. Let's just say that out loud. Sometimes we are wrong. And the times when we are wrong, I have coached people of color where they believe racism is the problem, and I have had to be the one to tell them, no, boo-boo, you are the problem. Like, here are the things that I would suggest you work on in your communication style, in your approach,
you know, in whatever area, we have to be open to the times and the places where we are, in fact, the problem. So who's most aware of it? I think we are, but I think sometimes we can put things on racism that are really personal accountability things.
Okay, I think that answered her questions. Did that answer your questions, ma'am?
My car dropped, and when I got back on, I heard at the tail end that you said who's most aware, but my question was who, in your opinion, is most confused or ignorant about racism, white supremacy, white people or non-white people? Just in your opinion, and why do you think so? So not necessarily more aware, but who do you think is just more confused or ignorant about the system, what it is and how it works, white people or non-white people?
Okay, so I think that white people are more confused, or maybe I would say, in answer to your question, I would say white people are more confused and lack the awareness about the impact.
Okay. All right, thank you for answering my question. I'll mute my line.
Right on. Before we nab our next caller, that was one question I was going to ask, because that is, you have a section, working while white, working while black, and you have different tips in both sections, and that's one of the tips in the section for working while black. You write, be open to situations when you are in fact the problem. Be objective, open-minded, and self-aware enough to notice when your behavior is the real issue. If you are fortunate enough to receive feedback, learn to recognize a long overdue aha moment and refrain from jumping to the conclusion that you are being discriminated against. And I was looking, and I will make sure I acknowledge, I am sure that that is true. There are times when the black person or non-white person, they have done something incorrect, and it is not racism directly that is the problem. I'm sure there are some instances where that is true. But I looked at the section, tips for working while white, and I didn't see any portion that said, well, there are going to be times where you are the problem and you're practicing racism and you need to own up to that. That seemed like that would be a natural corollary. If there are situations where the black person is doing something incorrect, it's not racism. Where there are times where a white person has to be doing something incorrect, practicing racism, and they should own up to that too. Why is that not included in the text?
I can't think of a specific situation in terms of me deliberately leaving it out. But I will say that the tips for working while white are all focused on, here are the things that you do that you need to not do. So, for example, there's a very clear part, I'm trying to find a page, where it talks about Black Lives Matter, and it says very clearly, do not say all lives matter.
Bottom of 91.
I'm sorry?
Bottom of 91.
Okay, good. Wow, you have really been in the book. Okay, so where it talks about, yes, help your colleagues to trust that you do not have a racist bone in your body, and the whole thing about do not use all lives matter. That, I would say, is one of those very direct, like, don't do this. This is what you do that is the wrong thing to do, if you will. And pretty much most of that list is, here are the things you do that are the wrong things to do. And the rest of the book are a series of different places where there are examples of things people do and say. So, for example, there's another dialogue in the book where someone asks one of the characters what they think about the situation with Bill Cosby. So I guess my answer to your question is that the book, throughout the book, are all these different examples of what white people do. And you're right, there isn't a specific bullet point that says sometimes you are, in fact, the problem. So I don't know. I don't have a solid answer for you. It wasn't a deliberate omission.
Well, appreciate that. Roz, did you have a question for Miss Allison Manswell? Roz, you should be with us.
Greetings to you, Gus, and greetings to you, Mrs. Manswell. Thank you for being on the program. I did have two questions. The first question is, do you think that white people go through a process of discerning who is a quote-unquote stereotypical black person versus someone who is not? And I just wanted to know, simply because I know you said you didn't have a foolproof way of discerning which white people are not racist, and I wanted to know if you think white people go through a similar process with black people, especially with the climate of how many citizens, regular citizens, as well as police have been killing our people.
Well, let me just say, I think police are a group by themselves. So I'm going to take police out of the equation for right this minute, because my answer as it relates to police might be different than the regular population at work. So the regular population at work, I think that we're all socialized by the same media and the same messages. And I don't think that any white person is any better at discerning than others. All of us are a product of our socialization and what we've been taught to believe about other groups. I have to say this to your listeners, and maybe this isn't a popular position on your show, but I do not believe that all white people are bad, and I do not believe that they're all out to get us. I believe that there's a system in place that is designed for systemic racism. I absolutely believe that. But as individuals, I just am not at a place where I personally believe that everyone is out to get us. I don't know that when people meet, when an individual white person meets me or meets any other white black person, I don't exactly know the thought process that goes through their mind. But I do know that they have been socialized to believe a certain thing that I might not be. They've been socialized to believe a certain thing. I don't know what personal experiences they've had that might override that. I don't know what education they've had that might override that. So I find it difficult to answer that particular question because, number one, I don't start from a place that every white person is out to get us. And number two, there's so many different factors behind how someone interacts with me. So I will tell you, when I go to get customer service somewhere, I start with being my normal, delightful self. And when I present myself as my normal, delightful self, and I receive a response that is stereotypically racist or discriminatory, I snap out of that in a minute, and I respond in a way that asserts what I'm there to get, what I'm willing to pay for, and the customer service that I expect. But I go into the situation with my normal, delightful self. So I don't know. I'm having trouble answering the question. Because I feel like there's so many different factors at work.
Roz, give me 1 second. I just wanted to ask, has anyone, myself or any of the callers, has anyone said that all white people are bad or all white people are out to get us being non-white people? Has anyone said that this evening?
No.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to ask that. Roz, did you have another question for Ms. Manswell?
Yes, I just wanted to know if you've ever experienced yourself or spoken to anyone who's black, who has experienced something called rhetorical ethics, and that essentially is just when a white person gives you that good vibration that you were talking about and makes you think that they really care about you or they have your best interests at heart, and then they turn on you and practice racism in a way that you're unprepared for simply because they helped you let your guard down by treating you in a way in which you thought that this person was a good person. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Absolutely. In my personal and professional life, absolutely.
Oh.
Yes, I have.
That was the only two questions you had, Roz?
Those are my two questions. The other one was kind of like a yes or no question, really. Just wondering, I'm not really asking you to put yourself in the thought processes of white people. I'm just asking for your educated opinion as to whether or not you think that when white people in general meet black people, that they take that approach of trying to discern the character of the black person, or do you think that they function in a way in which, I think you might call it unconscious bias, where they're trained to think a certain way due to the system, and that's it? Because like you said, you know, this it is a system, but the system is made up of individual people, and these people collectively function in a manner that has kept us in this position for a very long time. So that's why I'm asking that. Thank you.
Yes. So when people meet us, do they go through a process of discerning? I guess I would say yes. I think that people want to know, if we're staying in the workplace, in the realm of the workplace, there's a situation where when they encounter a black person, they might be going through an internal process to say, okay, is he competent? Can he do the work? And they go through a series of questioning that they may not go through if the person is a white person like them. I have a theory that I often talk about, which is my theory of awesomeness, right? And it's based on the fact that all of us walk through life thinking that we are each individually pretty awesome. And when we meet someone who looks like us, it's very easy to translate or transmit or give credit for our awesomeness to somebody who looks like us. But when the person doesn't look like us, it's a little harder. There's a little bit more risk. I'm not quite sure. And so there are more questions. So in answer to your question, I think that, yes, there might be a degree of questioning around our expertise that may not be there if a white person is talking to another white person.
Do you think that they tend to err on something negative when it comes to black people, or do you think they would tend to err on the side of something positive?
Probably err on the side of something negative. And I guess the reason I'm hesitating is because I don't know, I can't, my experience with people has been, I've had mixed experiences. So I am also reluctant to group all white people in the same bucket. But yes, I think that there is something in our programming that causes white people to question qualifications of a black person more so than they question qualifications of another white person. And quite frankly, there are studies that I have been privy to that demonstrate that, yes, that is actually the case.
Thanks for the questions, Roz. I'm trying to get some of our other callers. I did just want to submit, I think Kenneth Clark, his work that was used in the Brown v. Board of Education decision, Supreme Court decision in 1954, his Dahl experiment, I think would suggest that black people seeing white people tend to see them as being pretty awesome. And I think those results have been duplicated more recently, where we still see whites as being pretty awesome, generally speaking. The caller at 4789, did you have a question for Miss Allison Manswell? You should be with us.
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Two quick questions. I joined a little bit late, Ms. Manswell, so if you've answered this question, I apologize. I'm on your website, and I'm looking at the afterword by this gentleman, Howard J. Rawls, and there's a sentence that I would like to read and ask a quick question.
Sure.
He writes that while providing examples of how people in non-dominant racial groups can find ways to deal with the dominant community more effectively, she has not fallen into the trap of encouraging people to lean in and act more like the dominant group. I was wondering, what is the trap for, I guess, the non-dominant racial groups in acting more like the dominant groups? What is that trap? And then in the workplace, what are the consequences of falling into this trap of acting like the dominant group?
Oh, okay. That is a great question. And thank you for doing the research to be on the website. So Howard's remarks are directly related to Sheryl Sandberg's book called Lean In. I don't know if you're familiar with the CEO of Facebook. She wrote a book, I think it was probably about 5 or 6 years ago at this point, and it was a very popular book. Women all over the place were reading it. Men were reading it. It was this big workplace thing about lean in and how women should behave in the workplace. The premise of her book was basically that women need to act more like the dominant group, in this case men, and lean into their careers by basically trying harder. Now, that is a gross paraphrasing of her work, but what rubbed people the wrong way for the most part was this notion that we just need to try harder and lean in and be more like men. And she offers several tips of how to conduct yourself in the workplace, which pretty much tell you how to be more like a man. And the reason that her work did not resonate with many people because that's not a viable solution for women. And so Howard's remarks about, I haven't fallen into the trap of telling people to act more like the dominant group, is a direct is in direct relationship to that particular book. So that's the answer to the first question. Now, when you talk about what is the trap of acting more like the dominant group, I would say that that is when, as African Americans, we try to pretend that race and racism is not an issue in the workplace. When we, bounce through our careers believing that this is a level playing field, all things are equal, I'm just going to go to work and do a good job, and they're going to recognize the great job I've done, and I'm going to be treated equal. To be honest, to me, that is a trap. Does that answer your question?
What are the consequences of acting like that?
Well, if you actually go through your career believing that this is a level playing field and that all things are equal and that you are going to be judged just by the value of your work product alone, you will miss the fact that there are so many other facets to your career that you need to be focused on. The whole notion of career development and taking ownership of your career. This is another theme that goes in the book as well, is how, as African Americans, we can take ownership of our careers. I suggest that people look at their careers like they do their own personal, their family's intellectual property. So this notion of your company being responsible for your career development, that's a trap. You own your career development. It is up to you to figure out a career path. It's up to you to figure out what you really like to do. What would you like your next move to be? What kind of training, what kind of experiences, what kind of assignments, what kind of mentorship, sponsorship, or advocacy do you need to get to that next place in your career? That's a trap. So some of the downsides, if you go to work and just put your head down and think that you're going to be judged on your work product alone, the trap is that you're going to find yourself not moving forward.
Thank you. One last question. I saw that you are an MBA. Is that correct?
Yes, I am.
Have you been to the National Black MBA Association, to their conferences?
I have. Many years ago, I actually have attended as an attendee. I have not been as a speaker, but it is on my list. I would really love to have an opportunity to speak because I think that my message could really resonate with that population. But unfortunately, I haven't had an opportunity to do that yet, or maybe I haven't sought it out as well enough. So,
I remember. I've been there a few times. No. I mean, I've been there a few times, and one of the things that I notice is that a lot of the black people think that it's an event for them, and when they arrive, and it is mostly, basically, most of the people there are non-black. Most of the people that are there as candidates for jobs are non-black, and they end up being shocked. They end up being really disappointed. Some I've even seen get angry at such an event? Like, how would you, as a diversity consultant, how would you speak to these black students after such a disappointment of thinking that an event is for them, but it's actually not? It's like, how do you counsel people in such a situation that can be very difficult?
Oh, boy. I think that's representative. There's a phenomenon that I've noticed in the last several years, and that is we as in black people, went through a period where we didn't want to be singled out in events. We didn't want, you know, career development events that were just for black people. And in the meantime, other races, non-black people, figured out that, hey, they're going to hold this conference and recruiters, like big companies, are going to come there and recruit. And so it's open to everybody. So I'm going to go there and I'm going to be in the mix and I'm going to make sure that my resume gets put in the mix. And that's exactly what's happened. Other people have started taking advantage of these networking and recruiting opportunities. And that's why you have noticed that at those events, you have a lot of non-black people. What I would say to young black professionals, which is actually the message I would love to get out, there are a number of things that we need to do to own our careers, to take charge of our careers, that probably we could learn at these conferences. I still believe in the value of all of the different learning opportunities that they offer. You have to go, and you have to actually sign up for those things, and you have to go and meet the recruiters, and you have to know that you're going to invest the better part of your day to be networking and meeting potential employers. And absolutely, in the evening, you can attend all of the fun networking events, but you have to have some goals around who you're going there to meet, what kind of contacts you want, how much time are you willing to invest, how much, you know, smiling and shaking hands are you willing to do. So that's what I would say, is to go to those events and have a very strategic plan of who you want to meet.
I know.
Thank you.
Thank you. The caller, I guess you're on the vote line. Did you have a question for Ms. Allison Manswell? You should be with us.
Yes, good evening to everyone. Good evening, Ms. Manswell. I have two questions. Thank you. I heard, forgive me if I'm asking a question that's already been answered, and I think you touched on this a little bit already, but in regards, specifically in regards to the workplace, you said you kind of let your soul determine whether someone could be, I guess, racist or not racist. And I know it's hard to quantify, you know, the soul or anything like that, but can you give any tips of any, like, indicators that you look for to determine whether or not a white person is a racist or not a racist on the job? And I do have another question after that.
So if I meet someone, I try to have them meet my normal, delightful self. And in the course of just normal relationship building, I expect to see and hear a few things. I use my powers of observation to see, how do they treat the janitor in the building? How do they treat the CEO? How do they treat the receptionist? And I pick up my clues from all the indicators I get around, how did that person treat other people? If somebody comes to me and they are gossiping to me about somebody else in the office, I'm going to make the assumption that if I tell you anything, you're going to gossip about me as well. If I hear somebody make a comment or a joke about people of color, I'm going to take that as an indicator that they don't have the level of awareness that I would like them to have. So I think is it the spirit of discernment? Is it just the very, you know, basic things that we've all been taught? And is some of it just intuition that I can't quantify? That you meet someone and you'll observe things about them that will tell you everything you need to know. And Dr. Maya Angelou has this brilliant saying that says, when people show you who they are, believe them the first time. That's what I would say.
And my second and last question is, and again, this is particularly regarding white people who could be racist or possibly not racist. When you determine that they are a racist or are not a racist, what type of behavior, what's the difference in your behavior towards that person when you're interacting with that person, whether they, you determine that this person is a racist or this person is not a racist? What different behavior would you display towards that person? And that's my last question. Thank you.
Okay. I would say that I am pretty measured in my interactions in general. I'm a very open person. I'm very outgoing, very into relationship building. However, I am pretty cautious when it comes to workplace relationships. I don't necessarily give up very much of myself. I'm cautious in general. And that is actually one of the pieces of advice I would give, is that when you are in the workplace, assume that you're in a competitive environment. Assume that there's a bell curve that people could be graded on, and that if you receive a top grading, that somebody else is not getting a top grading. So assume that all the principles of competition are existing and that you should just be cautious in general. But again, don't suspend your trust in humanity just because you're in the workplace. You know, I also believe Einstein says that one of the most important questions man asks himself is this a friendly universe? And I think that at some point, I often will give people the benefit of the doubt, but just to the extent that they don't have enough ammunition to hurt me. You know, I'm always, you know, pretty cautious around people being able to do harm to me. However, I try to still maintain my trust in humanity. So it's just this delicate balance.
Appreciate that, caller. The retired firefighter in Florida, did you have a question for the extra delightful Allison Manswell?
Not always delightful, let me say that.
Good evening, everybody. Good evening, Miss Delightful. tests for promotions. Just give an example, fire department, especially the higher ranking tests, let's say for chief fire officer. There's been a history of, although the black person would take the test and perform very well on it, finish maybe in the top three or four. And there's a procedure that is done by either letting that person down the vine, so to speak, which is a metaphor for letting it linger and saying, well, there's no openings, or, you know, different type of shenanigans that goes on with so that that particular person will not get promoted, although they did very well on the test. What are your observations and or what are your remedies, possible remedies for an individual solving his or her problem?
That's a great question, and I'm very familiar with that type of shenanigans, if you will. I would say my advice to people is to document, document, document. Make sure that you are documenting what's going on. So in a case like that where there's some sort of test that needs to be taken, you document the date the test was taken, the date the score was taken. If you have any ability to get the scores of someone else, and or you can request the scores. So, for example, in an environment like that where a promotion is supposed to be based on test scores, you are denied a position, you have every right to ask for an inquiry into the person who was selected for the position, and you'd like to see how their scores compare to yours. And once again, when enough of us start asking these types of questions, we're going to challenge the shenanigans to the point that they don't occur anymore. You know, that's what I would say is document everything. And when people know that you are documenting, they are, you know, a little less likely to include you in their shenanigans. Sometimes, though, people will tell me, well, Allison, the very fact that they know I'm documenting means that they launch a campaign to get rid of me. And I've seen that occur as well. Whereas I don't have a solution for every single person in every situation, here's my advice for everyone. Number one, understand that your job is never designed to make you wealthy. We should all be having a backup plan A or plan B. There's also a part in the book where I talk about entrepreneurship. Like, if you are in a toxic work environment, you should be one of the first ones who is investigating how can you turn the skill that you're currently getting paid a salary or a wage for, how could you turn that into business income? And I hate for that to sound like a cop-out, but I don't know. I've just seen where it's necessary. It's not good for our health to just stay in a toxic environment. Sometimes there are things going on that you can't solve fast enough, and sometimes the solution is just to leave and to find someplace else to work. And sometimes the solution is to, you know, say your prayers and then get up and fight the system. So there's so many variations of answers. I feel like we just have to know all the different options and pick the one that makes sense for you in that particular situation.
Okay. Staying on this particular subject, as far as one of the options that is actually happening as I speak, I know someone did, to sue. What are the benefits? Well, I think obviously the benefit is you win the lawsuit. But what are some of the deficits of quote unquote suing your job in a situation like that?
Oh boy. So when a lawsuit is necessary, then that's what you should do. The benefits are pretty obvious if you win. Sometimes the benefits are just knowing that you did the right thing.
Okay.
You know, maybe that's the benefit. And maybe the win wasn't for you, but the fact that you made the lawsuit will cause some changes in behavior that will actually happen long after you're gone, but you were an impetus for change, and you might never see the change, you might never get credit for the change, but somewhere in the universe, you know, you get rewarded for having done that. To be quite honest, that's part of this book. There was no career benefit in writing this book. And I knew that there was a tremendous amount of risk. But it was the right thing to do that needed to be done. So that's what I would say about lawsuits, is that sometimes that's just what you have to do.
That reminds me of the baseball player. What's his name, Gus? I forgot his name. That Kurt Flood. Yeah. Okay. Thanks, ma'am.
You're very welcome. Thank you for calling.
We had a caller. She wrote in. She said, "Could you, Ms. Manswell, can you define what you mean when you say spirit.
Oh, boy. It's that thing within us that has no definition. You know, it's that part of ourselves that makes us divine. It's that connection to our Creator that's always there, that never leaves us. And if you can ever be in the workplace and you've ever been in a situation where you're in the workplace, you're conscious that you're in the workplace, but you have a situation where you just need to call on your inner strength, it's that. It's that part of us that lives at our core that normally we are very good at staying connected to. However, there are these situations, circumstances that cause us to become disconnected. And what I'm suggesting to us is that we learn how to harness that part of us, even when we are at work, to be able to deal with some of these situations.
Hmm. Hope that answers her question. A different person wrote in. She said, I think that the more Black people think that whites don't practice racism consciously, the more this problem exists. Would it not be beneficial for whites to pretend to be unconscious of racism so that racism can continue? That was her question.
Okay, I'm sorry. Can I ask you to repeat it?
Yes, ma'am. Would it not be beneficial for whites to pretend to be unconscious of racism so that racism can continue?
Okay, I understand. And I think that the caller is right. I don't believe in unconscious bias in every single situation. I don't. I teach about unconscious bias. I know there are some situations that are precipitated by unconscious bias. I could give examples of times when I felt that I was experiencing bias, and it was probably unconscious. However, there is an overabundance of reason to believe that a lot of what happens in the workplace is actually not unconscious, that it is actually very conscious. And the research that you mentioned that you had on the researcher you had on the show who talked about the academic environment, I'm sorry that I actually missed your show because I read that article and I was so proud of her courage to come out and say, oh no, you're right. Yeah, these are the things that we do consciously. I think that we need to start taking responsibility, holding people accountable for the stuff that they know that is being done. And quite frankly, there are a couple of examples in the book where I kind of shine the light on some things that happen very consciously that need to be done. Hmm. For example, there are companies that have senior leaders on their leadership team who everybody knows demonstrates behavior that goes against what they say they want with regard to an inclusive workplace. However, these leaders are allowed to continue to work and to create an environment that alienates other people. And to the extent we leave those leaders in place, we are definitely demonstrating conscious bias.
Hmm. Wow. Well, I think she answered that question as well. I did want to make sure I got in Jane Elliott. She did the Blue Eyes, Brown Eyes exercise, which is referenced in the book. She's been a guest on our program several times. She said it is not courageous for white people to talk honestly about racism, that it's not courageous at all. She's had decades of doing this work, and she's made a lot of money and traveled around the world. Mary Beth Gassman, she got her article republished in the Washington Post a couple times, and you know she's not under threat of death. I think that's another common misnomer, unfortunately, that these few whites who share one or two truthful bits of information about racism that they are courageous. And in fact, I'll quote one of our previous guests, Farrell Winfrey. She's an admitted white supremacist. She said, as white people, the most I can do is the least I can do to solve this problem. And I think that's a logical approach to take. You cited Dr. Robin DiAngelo in your work. She wrote about white fragility. She writes about racism a lot. Do you think that she is a racist, Dr. Robin DiAngelo?
No, I mean, I don't think she is. I think that she speaks honestly about some of the problems and some of the solutions.
Okay. Dr. Robin DiAngelo, according to one of our listeners, he heard her interview, she does admit to being a racist as a white woman, and she explains why. I said that I didn't think that that comes through in most of her writing. That's not something that she admits to on a regular basis. I certainly haven't seen that, but I will ask him to provide the evidence of her admitting to being a racist, but I did at least want to ask that. I thought sexual harassment would pop up in the book, and that didn't really, that wasn't really touched on. That's something that comes up regularly when we do our weekly session on workplace racism. Do you have any suggestions for dealing with sexual harassment? And I would definitely include unwanted touching, because we've had a lot of people as well, males and females, where it's someone coming and hugging them, and they've made it clear, you know, I don't really want to hug. Like, if we can handshake, and, you know, yeah, we work together and everything, but I just don't want to hug. And the person continues to insist on hugging them. Do you have any suggestions, recommendations?
Oh yeah, first and foremost, I don't tolerate anybody violating my body in a way that I don't want them to. So if I don't want to hug somebody, I would just say that, you know, I really am not comfortable with hugging in the workplace. I would prefer, my personal standard is a handshake. That's what I would prefer. That's what I do with others. And that's the way I want you to do with me. And I would have that conversation. And then I would have that conversation as many times as I need to. And I would have it in real time in the moment when the hug is about to happen, because I don't think anybody should be subjected to, you know, any kind of touching that makes them feel uncomfortable. That's just like my baseline. I have one of my personal feelings about sexual harassment is either one of two things. Either A, I'm not attractive enough to be sexually harassed, or B, I think I have an energy that comes into an interaction that says I am probably not the one. And I coach women on how to have that and to be able to powerfully stand for themselves when they feel they are being violated, or when they feel someone has spoken to them inappropriately, or is making a suggestion to them that is inappropriate. I believe in standing your ground when it comes to that, because there is no amount of salary or pay in the workplace that could cause me to violate who I am at my core, and I don't allow anybody to violate my body in any kind of way. So I tend to be on the rougher side of that, and that is definitely not the delightful version of me. But I encourage women and men to make their path and make their position very clear when it comes to workplace harassment.
Ashe, it is definitely B in terms of the energy that you give off to not be violated in that manner. Can you share kind of one of the things that you share in your coaching in terms of so that people can give off that energy to not be violated in their personal space?
Yeah, so let me just start off by saying one disclaimer. I am not blaming the victim by any stretch of the imagination. I am totally acknowledging that there are people who exercise their power and authority over others that has nothing to do with the energy they bring into the space, but has everything to do with the power and influence they think they have, and just exert that in ways that is inappropriate. So I want to just make that disclaimer first. And then secondly, in terms of coaching, and I'll start with women, I approach people and I tend to have a little bit more masculine energy when I'm in the workplace than when I'm home. And this is some coaching that I got way back when I had my children first. I actually had three boys. And I remember
a male family member saying to me, you better put some bass in your voice because those boys are not going to respond to your mommy voice. So I got a very clear sense that there's a way my voice projects when I'm in the workplace that subconsciously sends a message of male energy. That's one way. There are things about dress that there are certain types of clothes. I have a wardrobe that's for hanging out, and I have a wardrobe that's for the workplace. And never the two shall mix. So how I present myself in the workplace is a part of my brand. I am very much committed to people having a personal brand and being clear about what your employee brand is and what you want that brand message to be. And just like any tagline for any product, I am clear about what the tagline for my work is. And so when you have that framework of a brand, you'll find yourself operating like that at all times. And then, you know, there's all that other stuff around, you know, how you approach, where you sit at a table. I am very conscientious about where I sit for meeting. There are power positions around a table. If I'm the one leading a meeting, I don't allow someone else to sit in the power position. That's a whole body of work. My life coaching clients, as a matter of fact, I'm reminded of a life coaching client I have. I actually saw her on Sunday of this week, and we were working on a number of things regarding, her brand in the workplace. And we probably worked together. She had probably about seven or eight sessions. And the report she had was so incredibly positive of the changes that have happened. The answer for her was actually to change workplaces. She has a new job. She has a renewed sense of confidence. And some of those suggestions that I gave her specifically had to do with her practicing her brand and what she wanted her brand to be. And what I thought was brilliant about what she did was that she used that coaching on the job where she was to practice and perfect it. And so now that she's got this new job, she gets a chance to start all over from scratch and to go in there with this new brand. So these techniques are very, very effective.
Awesome. With, I guess you gave some for females. What about for males in terms of just one thing that you recommend to make sure they can try to preserve their physical space, not, you know, be subject to any sort of unwanted touching or physical violation?
Oh, yes. So specifically for African-American men, because there is something in our society that causes men and women, I would say especially women, to see African-American men as intimidating, I coach men to stand a little bit of a distance or turn your body in a way so that people are not feeling violated. So, for example, if you're standing talking with someone, be conscious of your body language so that they are feeling like they have more personal space than they might normally have with somebody else. And if in your personal relationships or when you're around other African-Americans, you might have a closer degree of personal space. But when you're interacting with someone, especially someone who's a woman, to just extend that personal space a little bit. I also coach men to not touch women at all in the workplace. That if you are meeting someone, it's fine to outstretch your hand for the traditional handshake. But beyond that, don't do extra things. Like, I've met men who will do the handshake with the right hand and then take the left hand and touch the arm or forearm or shoulder. And I coach, especially black men, don't do that. I coach them to do the other things that demonstrate listening, like lean in when people are speaking to you, but lean in such a way that people know it's because you're interested in what they're saying, but not in an intimidating way. And I actually hate to say this one out loud. I'm embarrassed to say this one out loud, but just like I talked about having to put bass in my voice as a woman, there are times when men should soften their voice so as to send a message of not being authoritative or overbearing. And sometimes for men, it's difficult for them to do that.
Why is that Why was that difficult for you to say?
Because I'm very conscious of African-American men feeling as if they have to blend into the woodwork and be invisible like the butler. And actually, in my research for the book, I did several focus groups with African-American men. And whereas height is a benefit for white men, height is seen as an inhibitor for some black men because it makes them even more inhibiting or intimidating. So I'm embarrassed to even say to black men to soften your voice because I don't want to add to that narrative of them disappearing into the woodwork. So that's the reason I feel embarrassed to even say it. However, it's just one of those tools and techniques. It's just like as a woman, I have no problem with putting bass in my voice when I need to.
Wow. We're finishing up Sam Greenlee's The Spook Who Sat by the Door, which in my view deals a lot with workplace racism. A part of the main character's lament is he says for him to succeed as a black male in a corporate work environment, he would have to give up his balls. And just how would you respond if folks who say, you know, some of your suggestions, which are totally logical, which I totally get as a black male, but how would you respond to people who say, well, what you are subscribing is self-emasculation. In order for me to be less intimidating to succeed as a black male, what would your response to that be?
So that's the reason exactly why I hesitated to say it. But here's what I would tell people. Number one, understand clearly the role of your job and your time and place in the workplace. It is not designed for you to build wealth or build generational legacy, financial legacy for your family. It is designed to keep your lights on and keep the internet running so that you can have some kind of enterprise that will do that for your family. So don't ever get to a place where your job is the sole source of your family's economy. And secondly, don't ever let go of that which makes you human, that which makes you whole, and frankly, that which makes you black. I also, you know, we have this saying, you know, I ain't got to do nothing but stay black and die. That is what I need to do. I need to continue to be me, and I would encourage all of your listeners, continue to be you, but understand what environment you're working in, understand the culture of the company that you work in, and by all means, please be as much of a change agent as your checkbook allows you to be. You know, push the envelope, challenge the system, be a change maker, challenge the status quo, be the one to raise your hand and say, you know, I'm sorry, I don't find that funny. Be the one to say, you know, this policy that we're doing, this recruiting strategy that I just saw come out of HR, I couldn't help but notice that it didn't include any HBCUs. Be the one to say these things out loud. We all need you to be the one to say this. Because when you leave, you know, people like me out there to be the only one saying this, then we sound like the outliers. So quite frankly, I need African Americans all over to begin to stand up and to say, this is not working for me.
Wow. Black self-respect once again, Allison Manswell, the website allisonmanswell.com. I didn't want to take up your whole evening, but I did want to make sure that I asked. This is from Chapter 6, Jim Moves to Action. Jim, again, is the white man who originally overheard the group of black people having some of their conversations about workplace racism, and he applies some of the things that he heard in that conversation. So to move forward in the narrative, and so he's talking, he says he knew that somehow the universe was moving him to a new way of thinking through seemingly coincidental experiences that altered how he thought about race in the workplace. First, it was the conversation he overheard in the restaurant. Then there was his brief debrief with Susan after her conversation with LaToya, and most recently, the president of their African American employee resource group sent him a video by Matthew Cook that shook his understanding of white privilege and the history behind the challenges America was facing. All of a sudden, he felt like he got it. He understood what felt like years of contempt for white males and the corresponding guilt
they felt about their success. That last sentence in particular, I just wanted to know, do you have any evidence that white men in particular feel guilty about their success?
That's a good question. I have actually heard from white men that they feel that there is a degree of guilt and that it's that guilt that causes them to refrain from these conversations. And I have heard or been made to, or somebody attempting to make me understand that part of the reason why people do not talk about race that much is because this sense of guilt keeps them paralyzed, if you will. So there's a subconscious acknowledgement that what has gone on has been wrong. What has continued to go on continues to be wrong. And this guilt keeps them from speaking it out loud, and that is the reason why they don't talk about race as much as we do. So I will say that the reason for me saying that, the evidence I have, is that I've actually heard that from white men.
That is interesting. It's, I don't know. I hear we talk to a lot of white people on this program, and spend a lot of time researching whites. That is pretty infrequent to hear white people that I believe, where they feel bad or guilty about racism.
Let me qualify this. Mm-hmm. Subconsciously guilty. I am not at all suggesting that they are overtly or consciously or willing to express their guilt. No, not at all. I would say subconsciously guilty.
Okay. You said you have talked to some white people, white males, I guess.
Oh, absolutely, yes. I have talked to some white males, and in the grand population, I mean, that's a minuscule handful, but they have actually said it out loud to me that there is a degree of guilt amongst white people, amongst white males. They understand their role in having created this problem and even perpetuated it to some extent, and there is a degree of guilt that causes them to not speak about it as openly and to be sort of crippled or paralyzed by that guilt.
Hmm.
Now, again, because I'm not a member of that group, I can't speak for them, but it's a plausible hypothesis to me.
Hmm. I haven't bumped into enough white people that I think are sincerely grieved about racism in any way, consciously and or subconsciously. In fact, I have seen way more whites who have bragged about. We just had the program yesterday where white people in Forsyth County, after lynching black people and kicking out an entire town of black people, well over 1,000 black citizens, they cleared out the black cemetery and used the gravestones as to make a footpath in their yard. So that's what you're walking on going up to the house. To see this sort of thing replicated 250 times, at least, these type of racial purgings, it's very hard. And there was no sense of guilt or remorse about this at all. And that's pretty typical. I just don't see a lot of guilt to the point of white people being stupefied about how to respond or deal adequately about racism. I haven't seen that as an adequate representation of whites in general, but.
And let me also just say, remember, we're all a product of our environment, and I am very aware that I work and my industry and my expertise tends to bring me in contact with people who sit around thinking about this very often.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, just from a statistical standpoint, my work brings me around people who think about this, or at least think about this in the way I think about this. And when I am called into a company or a corporation to work with a group, they have already gotten to some place of enlightenment, or else I wouldn't even be there. So I totally get how our experiences around that. My work happens to bring me in contact with people working towards solutions just by virtue of the nature of the work I do.
Got it.
Last question, just to end on black self-respect, because I think that comes through quite a few times in the book. You have a exchange later in the book between Maya and Rashunda. These are two of the black female members of the original five that we meet. And so they're having a discussion about how their careers have evolved, and I thought this was a really important segment. You could kind of touch on this before you leave us. And so Maya has corrected Rashunda. Maya's a little bit older, so she's correcting Rashunda. This is what Maya says. You were about to miss an opportunity to tactfully promote your success, but you glossed right over it. Obviously, you did an awesome job because another assignment came out of it, because you were too busy being humble and minimizing your accomplishment. That's part of why others get ahead of us. We haven't mastered the art of appropriate self-promotion. Start over and try that again. Can you talk about this passage and the art of, I guess, appropriate self-promotion?
Yes, I think that this is something that we need to do a better job of. We need to feel comfortable with it. And I know for me personally, my mother gave me the message of being humble. Don't go, you know, into the workplace and don't go anywhere else in the world thinking that you're so wonderful and you're so awesome, and that humility was part of what her expectation was of me. And so I grew up with that message ringing in my head. I brought that message into the workplace, and I couldn't help but notice that although my mama is brilliant or was brilliant during her time here, I couldn't help but notice that other people were better able than me to tactfully promote themselves, promote their accomplishments, and get the attention of senior leaders. And what I found was, while I was busy being humble, my achievements were being overlooked in favor of other people who had contributed less than me, and because they were better able to talk about what they had done, that they were getting my accolades. And so that passage is actually a very powerful personal lesson that I learned, where doing good work and just focusing on doing a good job is not enough, that I have to learn how to speak about my accomplishments tactfully and how humility has its place. However, in the workplace, I need to learn how to be appropriately self-promote.
Right on. I thought that was a significant passage as well. The website, it is AllisonManswell.com. It's linked in the description, so you can just click if you're listening at Black Talk Radio Network. But AllisonManswell.com, and you'll see the book. She has written other books as well. You'll see links to those, her blog, speaking engagements, all the information you need, contact information, AllisonManswell.com, the book we have been discussing, Listen In, Crucial Conversations on Race in the Workplace. Really, really fascinating read. Glad we could have you on the program. I did want to say, because I would say this regardless, the portion where I didn't get to ask my question, that was very important. The question I was going to ask, and I think we have done approximately 1,500 programs. We've had a lot of authors on the program. I think that's the first and only time we've had a spoiler stoppage, something that I thought was a very important question. But I will definitely honor your request to spur interest for people to get the book, AllisonManswell.com. But definitely appreciate you coming on the program to speak with us.
Absolutely. And you know what? You're making me feel badly now. If you would like to still ask the question, by all means, I will answer. I'm very sensitive about that one part of the book because it was such a surprise to me, and I have this thing where I want readers to experience it as a surprise. However, I don't want you to leave feeling like it was an incomplete interview. So if you have to ask the question, I will retract my previous statement and I will answer. It's entirely up to you.
I thank you kindly. I will ask the question then. What would your response be to folks who say that it is not valid to compare racism, white supremacy, to any other form of oppression, regardless of what we're talking about, that it is not a valid comparison in terms of what's happening with racism, white supremacy, specifically if we're talking about homosexual activity.
Absolutely. So I actually agree that sexual orientation is not appropriately compared to racism. And that is actually where the notion of sexual orientation comes up in the book. The point that's made through the dialogue between the characters is that exact point, that it is not an appropriate comparison to make, and that they are two totally different things that need to be handled in two totally different ways. I will say that the LGBT community has made strides with their issues that, compared to the fact that we've been working on civil rights for 50 years and they've only been working on LGBT issues for about 20 years, I am amazed at the strides that they've made. And there might be a few strategies that they use that we could employ for the social justice issues that we need. I think that there are strategies we can learn from. However, the two issues are two totally different issues and should not be compared or used as one in the same. So, yes, that is actually one of the themes in the book, that they are not equal.
Hmm. Why do you think the gay rights initiatives and their organizing, why do you think they have been more successful than black people, non-white people, in dealing with racism?
Well, notwithstanding the fact that it was predominantly promoted by rich white men, let's start there, rich white men that galvanized around one issue and used all of their political capital, financial capital to promote that one issue. And once again, the group itself are rich white men.
Hmm. Hmm. Definitely that hugely significant factor, the number of white people that were promoting that the gay rights issues and LGBT initiatives. On page 94 on the Working While Black Tips for Black People, it reads, this is, I guess, one, two, three, four, the fourth bullet point. It says, be sensitive to the challenges of other groups. Several years ago, I had a white male who reported to me. He came back from a meeting and was visibly upset. He finally admitted to being infuriated by a comment made by a very senior male executive who said, guess you still aren't ready to be promoted. This was a direct reference to his facial hair. The executive was retired from the military and held the belief that clean shaven was the standard for male leaders. The feelings of isolation I previously had about my braids morphed into empathy for his facial hair issue. I realized that many of us make choices that might be burdensome. Other groups, for example, the LGBT community, differently abled individuals, and other ethnic groups have workplace challenges as well. What would your response be to someone who says this, again, seems to be conflating, equating the experience of black people under white supremacy racism with LGBT or ableism or other groups?
To be honest, I can't imagine somebody saying that, because that is one bullet point in an entire book that is focused on race. No, I can't imagine somebody saying that to me. I will say, though, that this is actually a real scenario. This actually did happen to me. And the point that is being made here is that I would like people to come away from reading this book with some degree of empathy and insight, not just into race, but into a balanced look at race. And the point I'm making in this bullet is that I had a moment where I understood for the first time in a way that I had not understood before, that a white male who felt compelled to shave his facial hair every day to come to work was making a choice similar to me when I have to decide, when will I put my braids in, when will I take my braids out.
I understand it's not the same thing, but it's the same concept that he's having to change a portion of himself to be accepted at work. One of the things I wanted this book to do is to show that African Americans can think in 360 degrees. I can think on both sides of this issue. I can think on all the different ways that other people will experience race and even exercise empathy for other groups. For example, I've been very fortunate to never be disabled. And so I experience the workplace as a, you know, with all my limbs working, I can run upstairs, I can do everything, but I'm also conscious that someone who is differently abled, somebody who's in a wheelchair, will experience the workplace in a different way than I do, and it will be harder for them. Now, my ability to exercise empathy for that group does not diminish the severity of racism. It just says that I can exhibit empathy towards that group. So I'm really hoping that people will read this book and will see that one bullet that shines a light on another group's challenges does not negate the rest of the book.
Well said, well said. AllisonManswell.com. AllisonManswell.com. I appreciate you being general, even allow me to get in my extra question there. I wanted to clarify as well. I didn't want someone to have answered for you or what have you, because I thought we had another caller on as well. When I asked that question before about did anybody hear during any course of the broadcast, did anybody say that all white people were bad or all white people were out to get us? Did anybody say that during the course of the program?
And let me just, I understood the nature of your question, and please don't misunderstand my answer either.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be clear that I fully understand the impact of race in the workplace. And this book is written from a scholarly perspective. It might be written as fiction, might be written as a novel. There's even a little bit of steamy dialogue in it and all of that. I had somebody tell me that it should actually have been called 50 Shades of Racism. I totally understand that there's very strong feelings about racism and racism in the workplace, but I also want to send the message that this is a well-balanced book that includes dialogue that people can embrace and see both sides. You'll find that the characters themselves disagree. They have a very heated conversation about black-on-black crime. It is designed to show that even within our community, everybody doesn't think the same way. And so I'm hoping that that balanced message comes out as well.
Oh, right on. The question was, I just wanted to be sure, did anybody say, did you hear any of us, myself, any of the callers say that all white people were bad or that all white people were out to get us? Did anybody say that this evening?
Oh, no, I didn't hear that per se, but I did hear there was a little bit of, in the questioning, it seemed a little bit as if, how should I put it? It seemed that there was a little bit of leaning towards, I don't know, maybe I was misinterpreting, but it seemed like something there around how we experience this as victims. And we absolutely do. That's the whole reason for needing a book like this. And I don't deny that by any stretch of the imagination.
Right on. Glad we got that clarified. The book again, Listen In, Crucial Conversations on Race in the Workplace. AllisonManswell.com, the website. Super delightful today. We appreciate you hanging out with us on the program and allowing us to get our questions in. Continue the outstanding work. I know this is an issue that we do care about, so I'm sure folks will be checking out your blog, your website, seeing where you're going to be doing speaking engagements to follow up to see more what you have to say and get your views and what have you.
Sure. And if your listeners have a group that they would like to have me as a speaker to, please contact us through our website, and I would be happy to see if it's an engagement that I'm able to do, and we have information about how to get me as a speaker and, what are the costs and conditions. So by all means, I appreciate that, as well as any of your listeners are interested in career coaching. That's another service that I offer as well.
AllisonManswell.com. AllisonManswell.com.
Check out the website. Thank you again for being so generous with your time. I wish you the best with all of your different endeavors and the books. Keep up the outstanding work.
Thank you, sir. Thank you so much for having me, and to all of your listeners for engaging with their questions. Peace and blessings.
For sure. Have a safe evening. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good evening. Context of White Supremacy, Allison Manswell, guest for the evening. The book, again, is Listen In, Crucial Conversations on Race in the Workplace. I have to give credit, Renithia Tate. She's been a guest on this program quite a few times. Her book, Pieces of a Puzzle, about the eighth area of people activity. But she, I think she heard the program that we did over the summer on workplace racism, where we played that segment that we started with today from NPR, where they referenced Ms. Manswell's work. That was the first place that I heard about her book. And this was, I don't know, maybe a month ago. Renithia Tate was like, hey, who was that that did the book? Did she come on the program? And I was like, dang, because if you anybody that remembers, that was from like July. I said, I need to get in touch with Ms. Manswell. She's wrote a whole book on workplace racism. Like, we need more literature on that subject matter. But she jogged my memory, as they say, Renithia Tate, and reminded me to get in touch with her. I did, and there you go. Also wanted to make sure I got in as well. This is our, I think, 10th consecutive day broadcasting. Man, it has been a doozy. I don't have as much time to check the paper out and everything, but we have been rolling, got books read for the program. I always think it's constructive when we can be on for consecutive days. Just the sequencing of the programs often reveals a lot, and make sure that I'm being codified with my use of time and energy so that I'm not, you know, wasting time or what have you. I always think that that's good, and hopefully people are getting constructive information as we have been on more regularly. It will continue. We'll be here tomorrow for Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Friday, wrapping up Spook Who Sat by the Door, Sam Greenlee. Same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll be here Saturday, Compensatory Call-In, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. And then on Sunday, we'll be here, Mr. Charles Woods. He is a black male. He's done a lot of work about racism and the film industry, film and television. So he'll be here on Sunday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. So tune in. I hope it has been constructive for folks listening to the program. I know one of the patterns that has been a theme throughout has been white people are stupid and or white people are ignorant, unaware of racism. That has been a running theme throughout the last 10 days that we've been on the air, where white people, non-white people somehow alleging, asserting that white people are ignorant, unaware, stupid about the business of white supremacy, racism. I certainly have my opinion on that, but that has been a common thread throughout the program. Interesting, I thought, with the broadcast that we had yesterday about the purge in Forsyth County, Georgia, very interesting follow-up to the conversation that we had today. At any rate, folks have any quick comments that they want to share, great questions from the listening audience. The only thing that I thought of about this program is that I wanted to make sure I picked out some of the things that I thought were very constructive in the book. Black person being serious about things that we should be serious about, especially workplace racism, trying to put out some constructive information. So I didn't want it to be anything where just because I knew we were going to have some points of disagreement about white people being unconscious about racism. I wanted to make sure I raised some of those points, but also try to point out constructive aspects of the book as well. I definitely thought the gay rights issue was important. I'm so glad she allowed me to ask about that, because I thought that was an important part of the book. So I'm glad we got to hear her thoughts on that as well. Folks had anything they wanted to, a quick thought they wanted to get in before we wrap things up, should be with us. Anyone had a quick comment they wanted to get in before we conclude?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I did. I had a question I was hoping to get to, but in the end, I decided to not try to squeeze it in. But I did want to ask her,
the way I wrote the question was, is this optimism, and I put optimism in quotes, regarding white people's response to what she deemed as a crucial issue? And is it warranted? Is it productive? And is it strategic? And the reason I wanted to ask her that is because we have a history of empathizing with them throughout inhumane suffering and torture at their hands. We've always empathized. We were conditioned to empathize with Christianity. So I don't think that there's been a lack of empathy on our part for other groups suffering. So presenting that as a way of dealing with this issue, I just don't see how that would be warranted at this point. I think that we as a people probably are experiencing as a whole battle fatigue. Productive or strategic, if we continue with the same moves, we're going to get the same results, which is just a facade of we're going to fix it and then the slow decline back to where they want us to be. Does anyone else feel that way?
Before I nab response, I did want to add the one person, because I don't think this person got to ask a question at all. Ms. Manswell, the call, oops, sorry about that. Caller at 4683. Did you have a question that you wanted to add in, or if you wanted to respond to the previous caller's question?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Well, I just really wanted to make a statement if you want to, but it was pertaining to that, but I can wait.
You can make your statement, sir.
Well, I was just going to say, when she was speaking about the, when you asked her about the so-called some good white people and people being humble on the job, man, it's no good white people. And she, this the game, and I noticed that I had got in with the white lady on the other day. And what I'm thinking it is, and with a lot of the, a lot of smart black people, this has become a topic to make money, to generate revenue for intellectual people, and to get that validation, like somebody spoke on the other day too, right? And because there's no really no solution. And then you have people talking about, people that they like for black people to look at them like that and to praise them. And, they make pretty good money about talking about this and writing about these things. And we all can be humble. I'm humble. I ain't out here trying to kill nobody or just run over white people. But there ain't no such thing as no good white people. All white people look at all of us the same. And it's just like most of us on this program that are becoming aware, we look at them the same. You always out there suspicious. And I'm going to mute my line, but I was going to ask you too, Gus. I went and seen that Birth of a Nation Sunday, man. I wanted to see if I could give my review on it towards the end when you get the rest of the people in. And I'll mute up.
We'll make time for that. Was there a female caller that spoke up who was going to share as well? I thought I heard a female voice who spoke up as well. Maybe I didn't. Are there other folks who had comments that they were going to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I wanted to just ask if you can reiterate the question from the previous female caller.
Ma'am, you want to restate your question?
Yes, it was more so in regards to us repeating when she was saying the belief that all white people aren't bad and all white people aren't out to get us and this empathizing with other groups' pain. And I was saying that is this optimism regarding the white response to this. She deemed it as a crucial issue, so she can see that we are in a crucial position right now. And I was wondering if that approach was warranted because we've been doing that for centuries. Is it productive? Because for the centuries we've been doing that, it hasn't improved our lot in the white supremacist system. And is it strategic? Is that the move that we want to make at this time? Is to show empathy for other groups that have shown no empathy for us under the guise of ignorance of our suffering.
Okay, thank you for that. I think, essentially, until the system of white supremacy is replaced with a system of justice, every single white person, even if it's an embryo, is a racist as far as I'm concerned. And that's why I asked her the questions that I asked in regards to whether or not she thought that white people saw black people with the same level of discernment that that she says she sees white people with, as far as her not thinking all white people are out to get us, as she put it. And to me, it's no dig on her as a person. I just think that's just the way she functions, just how she chooses to deal with racism, white supremacy, VGQ, in reference to how she chooses to. But for me, that's just a dangerous proposition. Actually, when I heard her speaking, it really brought me back to something I deal with my wife quite a bit in regards to how she views white people. And I've said this before, one of the biggest reasons why she said this to me before is that she'll take people as they come. If a white person treats her nice, then she'll be nice to them. And if they're not nice, then she, you know, leaves them alone, or she'll be not nice back. And the same thing would apply to black people. And what her biggest issue has been is that the most visceral mistreatment she's experienced has come from the hands of our own people. And that is what, from our discussions, has shaped her consciousness in that way. So I don't know if Mrs. Mansfield had a similar experience, or if that's just the way, you know, her life is going with that, especially with the fact that she does motivational speaking and all kinds of things, where I'm pretty sure she comes into contact with quite a few white people as well as black people. So I think just because her focus, as far as the work she does, doesn't solely focus on black people, then it would make sense that she would have a view that's a little more universal in that regard, because it also facilitates the work that she does. Whereas, like I said, my whole ideology is essentially, you know, all of them are racist, and some are just more refined than others in the way that they practice racism. And that's been my full experience my entire life. I cannot sit here and honestly say, that I've ever met a white person who is not racist. That's just what it is. And I did the same thing Minister Malcolm did in the movie. I took stock of every white person I ever met, and there's not one that I can sit back and say, wow, 100%, I've never experienced racism with this person, or they've never said something or done something in some form or fashion to express that they're racist in some form or fashion. So I just think, just because of the type of work she does, I think that's essentially what facilitates her worldview in a bigger way than it would for some of the rest of us who don't come from that sort of perspective, where you have to be more universal in your approach, because it also facilitates your livelihood. So that's pretty much what I think. I think she gave some good information in regards to some of the questions that were asked in regards to like Thomas Smith's question, the question that Gus had proposed, which I'm glad he did, in regards to the black female that was being sexually accosted and molested on a regular basis. So I think she has constructive information, absolutely. But there's just a lot to sift through, simply because her approach is not an approach where, to me, there's a higher level of understanding of the way the system of white supremacy functions. And it's no dig on her whatsoever. I just understand why she sees things how she does, and it kind of reminded me of my wife. Thank you, and I'll be my line.
I agree 100%.
There are other folks who had commentary. Everybody satisfied? I'll assume everybody is good. Grand.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, sir. I was going to make time for you to get your movie review in as well. I was just going to make sure I remind folks we'll be here tomorrow. Tomorrow's Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. If you have workplace racism-related events, observations, things you would like to share, feel free to drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, and we can read them on the program. Keep it anonymous if that's the way you would prefer. We'll be looking forward to that tomorrow. I, too, appreciated some of her commentary around dealing with sexual harassment, unwanted touching,
on the job, and documentation. It's always great to hear someone include documentation because that's something I think is very important to make sure we're doing as well. Anyway, we will be here tomorrow. Sir, you want to give your review of Nate Parker's The Birth of a Nation?
Yes, sir. Hey, man, let me tell you too, man, thank you. And I want to thank all the callers, man. I really appreciate the show. And what I was really trying to allude to earlier is, see, you could tell the difference in between the peoples that participate and the guests. You see, when it comes to the, what people say as far as how people look at the racism issue, right? But anyhow, there's no disrespect to Mr. Nate Parker or Nat Turner. You know, I respect both of them. But their movement is, I do not promote their movement. I didn't like it. I'm in Bismarck, North Dakota, right? I went and seen it. Now, when you look at that grand theater, it looked like Egypt. It looked like you in the tomb or pyramid in Egypt. The whole movie theater got gold statues of Egyptians and stuff. So when I'm the only person in the movie, right, which was cool, but I see white supremacy all in the production. Now, these are my thoughts. Now, white people love to be able to call people niggas in these movies and get paid for nigger wanches. But the thing what really throwed me off was, okay, now I done read several accounts of Nat Turner. Nowhere ever did I read or even heard that it was a courtyard, confrontation where all the black people and all the white people meet in the courtyard and, you know, just charge at each other. You know how white people always play in their movies where they meet up and everybody just run at each other. You know, it's always been that tournament up. They went throughout the time and was killing, you know, white people, kids and all. So anyhow, that was the first thing where I ain't like. It wasn't really like no historical thing or whatever. But also, I don't know if anybody else seen it, but Mr. Parker got had an interview with another brother from Virginia. And he was talking about, now he specifically talked about the religion and the white God and the white Christian, Jesus, how the white people had to use Nat Turner and were doing all this. You know, he had a lot of, you know, things to say about white God, white Jesus, and religion on this interview on YouTube with this other black brother, right? And then at the end of the movie, it had a little black girl. It had a Drake club. She was up in the air like an angel with white wings, all dressed in white. You know what I mean? So the movie kind of just, I ain't like it, man. And I done watched all the slave movie. It ain't no different than the other one. You know, and that's not to down talk Mr. Parker, because he is in the system of white supremacy, you know, and the white supremacy got to approve the movie and put it out there and put the money behind it. But I you spent my money to go in there, but you know I kept been hearing about it, and so I was like, man, I'm gonna go see it, cause you know I never seen nothing, you know that's the first Nat Turner move, but we done all heard them accounts, and I'm wondering, has anybody ever heard that they met up in the courtyard, you know, like 300 or Troy? All the more Roman war movement where everybody just meet up in a little court and just charge at each other like it's an old, old European war type of movement, man. And I never heard that. And I done read plenty of articles about Nat Turner, and I've never heard that. And with that, man, I just want to say thank you again, bro. I'm glad you've been running like this all week. I be catching up at work, man. So, you know, and I appreciate y'all, man. You know, it's coming along. I'm going to meet Milan, though.
Appreciate that. For this week, that is two thumbs up for The Birth of a Nation, one thumb down for The Birth of a Nation. I'm sure as other folks choose to see it, they can share their thoughts, observations on Nate Parker's new film,
With that, we will be here tomorrow. I was reminded at the beginning of the program when our guest, she was talking about this book. It starts with four friends who get together and have drinks after work and talk about workplace racism. I was reminded even then, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Our behavior, I think, should reflect at all times that war is being waged against us. That is what racism means, and that we should make sure that we are in the best position possible to make phenomenal decisions. We never know when we are going to have to make life-saving, life-threatening, life-challenging decisions as a result of racism, white supremacy. So particularly if you're going to be in a vehicle, driver, passenger, even as a pedestrian, you do not want to be under the influence and have that be the day that you are stopped by Darren Wilson, Daniel Holtzclaw, any of these other race soldiers, badge or no. Let's make sure that we are adequately conducting ourselves in a counter war strategy. And I don't think being under the influence, cigarettes included, should be a part of that. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.